Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
All right, I'm going to start out tonight by being redundant.
No.
Well, okay, this one time.
I'm going to start out tonight being redundant.
I get it.
You've heard me say over and over and over again, I get a lot of email. And boy, don't I. But let me tell you, so far this month, we have received email from China.
Yeah.
We have received email from Australia. We've received email from Poland, from London. Today, from Italy, a listener that writes occasionally from Italy, we literally get email from around the world. And I know that, but you guys don't always know that because you don't get all the email. And sometimes the email is, people asking theological questions. And so that's a two-way conversation. They write, they ask questions. I write back with answers. That's that conversation. Sometimes it's people who just want to pick a fight. Fortunately, those are becoming less and less, fewer and fewer, and I'm glad for that. Sometimes it's email that's just so complimentary that it would be self-serving for me to share it with you. And sometimes it's the kind of email that just humbles me. It just stops me in my tracks and makes me think this is why we do what we do. And so I'm going to share one of those with you tonight. This one says, Dear Pastor McLarty, this is my third attempt at writing this email. I really wanted to express what GCA and what you provide means to me, but I keep rambling on. So I will shorten it up. I am sure the following statements deserve explanation, but since this is my third attempt, I'm just going to have to let it go. The wife and I are going to try to come and visit GCA after our sixth child is born, a girl who's coming real soon. So here are my interjections. Number one, a pre-trib Sovereign Grace pastor with resources available on the internet. Whoop, whoop. W-H-O-O-P, according to him. Number two, the resources are free, 3 exclamation marks, triple whoop. Are you correcting my whoop?
It's okay. Do you just pronounce it whatever you want?
You're 17, correct me.
It's whoop, whoop.
Is it whoop, whoop? Whoop?
Not whoop, whoop.
Okay, I'm totally with you, okay.
I'm sorry, I'm back in my spot.
Triple whoop. Number three, my wife now understands the doctrines of grace by listening to GCA's teaching on Colossians, Exodus, Ephesians, 2 exclamation marks, that is a big quadruple whoop. Notice, by the way, one of the reasons I like that comment is that it said she came to learn the doctrines of grace listening to Colossians and Ephesians, okay, we would get that, and Exodus. Isn't that interesting? Because I keep saying that the Bible teaches the same theology throughout. And these midweek Old Testament teachings, I think sometimes people go, well, you know, he's teaching through the first 5 books of the Bible. There's probably no theology there. Ancient history of people walking through the sand somewhere. But there is so much solid theology in these books. And I love the fact that he included the book of Exodus there. Number four, a sermon on eating the priest's food by a guest speaker. You remember that one? That was Barney Johnson. A sermon on eating the priest's food by a guest speaker had tears running down my cheeks while standing in a Chinese restaurant. Number five, me to my wife. Hey, hon, this guy on the internet is saying just about everything I have been thinking for the last 10 years. Number six, I am hooked. I feel like I am part of GCA, even though none of you has ever met me. I hope to see you all soon. If not here, then in the air. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Whoop, whoop.
Where's he from?
I do not know. In any case, that's why we do what we do. Exactly that. When people write and say, I get it, or my wife gets it, or you're saying things that I've been saying for 10 years, and you know how lonely it can be out there in the church world if you actually believe the things we believe. And then to write and say that kind of stuff, it reminds me yet again that every time we meet here and we turn on the recorder, we have no idea who we're talking to. We don't know where they are in the world, and yet it continues to have a profound effect, not because of who we are, but because of how effective this word is. I get emails sometimes from people who say, you know, all you do is just, you just teach the Bible. That's all you do. I don't know what else they thought I would do. They're audio recordings. They can't see me dance. I don't know what they're expecting. But the reason all we do is teach the Bible is because of emails like that. Because only the Word of God, exegetically, properly, contextually taught, produces those kind of results. Yes, Conrad?
Hebrews 4:12 is just coming to life.
Quick and powerful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, did everybody get a chance, since I just read this from an internet listener, did everybody get a chance to meet our internet listener who's here this evening? Came all the way from Kansas City to spend a Wednesday evening with us. He'll have to come back someday on a Sunday and meet the actual congregation. But whoop. No, tonight you've met the saved ones.
Yeah.
So, you know, these are the ones you'll see in heaven. Turn to the book of Numbers. We are in Numbers 32. We're going to try to make some real progress tonight. I'm going to try to move quickly and reach a point that I'm gunning for this evening. Hopefully we'll be able to do it. We are going to read chapter 32, but I'm going to read it out pretty completely because it is largely narrative, not a lot of theology going on, but it is an important bit of narrative because now we're reaching the point where the Israelites, the second generation of the Israelites that have come out of Egypt, they're finishing their 40-year journey, and they're now entering the Promised Land. And God is beginning to set out boundaries of land that they are each going to inherit. He's going to make their land inheritance a permanent inheritance. Every bit of land that God assigns to a particular tribe of Israel becomes theirs in perpetuity. And then he even lays out rules about things like every 50 years, everything I've given you reverts back to its original owner. So there's no way for them to even contractually change what God has set in place. This one more time shows God's absolute sovereignty over little things like who lives where and what land he gives them and where he assigns them and where he places them. I tell people all the time, wherever you are, wherever you're going, wherever you end up, that's exactly where God intended you to be. We see that laid out very clearly here in his dealings with Israel and assigning land allotments. But prior to them going in and taking the actual land of Canaan, they have to cross the River Jordan. They haven't done that yet. We just saw that they had their war with the Amorites. And at that point, Reuben and Gad look around at the land that belonged to the people they just conquered. Remember, they wiped out the people. And last week we saw the distribution of all the stuff they took in that war. So Gad and Reuben, who are the two biggest tribes, take a look around at the land that they've just conquered and say, you know, this would be really good land for us. And they negotiate a deal to stay there and not go across the Jordan. But that also weakens the army of Israel. And so the leaders of Israel have to confront the leaders of Reuben and Gad and say, you're either going to come fight with us or you're not going to get your land. So that's what we're about to read here in chapter 32. Now the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad had an exceedingly large number of livestock. So when they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, that it was indeed a place suitable for livestock, the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben came and spoke to Moses and to Eleazar the priest and to the leaders of the congregation, saying, Ataroth, Dibon, Jazer, Nimrod, Heshbon, Elealeh, Sibon, Nebo, and beyond. The land which the Lord conquered before the congregation of Israel is a land for livestock, and your servants have livestock. And they said, if we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants as a possession. Do not take us across the Jordan. But Moses said to the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben, shall your brothers go to war while you yourselves sit here? Now why are you discouraging the sons of Israel from crossing over into the land which the Lord has given them? This is what your fathers did when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. You remember what that's a reference to? 40 years earlier, they had been in that same place. And rather than go take the land, they sent in spies. And the spies went in and looked at the land and came back and said, it's exactly like you described it. Land flowing with milk and honey. Brought back enormous clusters of grapes and fruit to show how wonderful the land was. And just about the time everybody went, yes, it's just like we heard it was, they said, and oh yeah, we saw giants in the land. And we saw fortified cities. And we saw ourselves as grasshoppers in their sight. We can't take that land. They're stronger than us. And that's why God said, all right, that's going to get you 40 years of wandering. I brought you right here to the land I promised you. It's exactly like I told you it was going to be. And now because you don't have any confidence in God to give that land to you, I'm going to strew all the bones of the first generation that came out of Egypt in the wilderness, and your children are going to inherit the land. Now here they are 40 years later, same place. The last census they took, same number of people. Even though the first generation was wiped out, there's the same number of people standing there in the exact same place about to take the same land, and Reuben and Gad come forward and go, you know, we're thinking we're not going to go. And so they are confronted by Moses, and he says, why are you discouraging your brethren from going and taking the land? Don't you remember we did this once before and it didn't go well? This is what your fathers did, verse 8, when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For when they went up to the valley of Eshcol and saw the land, they discouraged the sons of Israel so that they did not go into the land which the Lord had given them. So the Lord's anger burned in that day. And he swore, saying, none of the men who came up from Egypt from 20 years old and upward shall see the land which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, for they did not follow me fully, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, and Joshua, the son of Nun, for they have followed the Lord fully. So the Lord's anger burned against Israel, and he made them wander in the wilderness 40 years until the entire generation of those who had done evil in the sight of the Lord was destroyed. Now behold, you have risen up in your father's place, a brood of sinful men, to add still more to the burning anger of the Lord against Israel. For if you turn away from following him, he will once more abandon them in the wilderness, and you will destroy all these people. Now, by the way, look at what they just did, because this is interesting. They just took something that happened 40 years earlier. Moses was alive to remember it. Aaron was alive to remember it. And then Joshua and Caleb were alive to remember it. Everybody who was alive 40 years previously when what happened happened were now all dead in the wilderness. And so the young people were there to remember all that. They were children at the time, and now they're being instructed by how God acted before to understand how God is and how God acts now. They're being instructed in the kind of God they're dealing with based on how God acted 40 years before that. You understand what I'm saying? Because that's precisely what we're doing here. That's why we still go back and look at God's activity 3,400 years ago. And we read about the God that some people say, well, that's the God of the Old Testament. But the God of the Old Testament is the God of the New Testament. It's the exact same God. And so by studying the way he is, the way he acts, the way he reacts, we get to know him. We get to know his personality. One of the things that the writers bemoaned was the fact that all Israel saw God's actions And only Moses came to know God's ways, got to know what God was like, as opposed to just watching God do stuff. Boy, this kind of ties into what you and I were talking about, doesn't it, Bob? It's one thing to say, well, I expect that God exists, and therefore I am going to react to the reality that God exists, and I am going to spend some portion of my life in reaction to the fact that God exists, and therefore I'm going to worship in some way, be part of some kind of God community, spend some amount of time maybe knowing something about the Bible, and then I'm going to identify myself as a Christian or at least a God believer on that basis. Everybody in Israel who came out of Egypt walked through the Red Sea. For 40 years, they all ate bread that fell from heaven. They knew he existed. They knew he was real. They were at the foot of Mount Sinai when the dark cloud covered Mount Sinai, and they heard his voice. And it scared them so badly, they told Moses, go talk to him and tell him not to do that anymore, because that's frightening. They knew he was there. What they didn't know was what he was like. And as a consequence, they ended up with their bones strewn through the wilderness. 40 years, this second generation has been walking with Moses. For 40 years, they've had the law that they received at Sinai. For 40 years, they were working to keep the law. They were doing the stuff. They were reacting to the fact that God existed, but they hadn't come to know what he was like. They hadn't come to understand his ways. And so they could do something as foolish as 40 years later say, you know, we're not going to go over with you. The two big tribes, Reuben and Gad, who had lots of livestock, so they said, well, you know, this is good for us. And because it's good for us, it's probably good for God, because this is what we prefer. And so we'll stay here with our livestock, and you all go across Jordan, and I hope that works out well for you. Bye now. They come to him and say, have you learned nothing about God? Let's look back at how God was and use that as our example of how God is. That's why we take the time to go through these studies of how God was 3,400 years ago. It's because he's exactly like that still. Now, if there had not been an intercessor between you and that God, you'd be in deep trouble because you'd be exactly like Reuben and Gad. You'd be spending your time going, I'll tell you what's good for me. And then I'll just expect God to go along with what's good for me. And as long as God agrees with what I think, I'll let him be my God. And we'll have a nice relationship. I have a wonderful plan for God's life. But if you take the time to study the old stuff and find out what God is really like, then you'll understand that that God has absolutely no problem with punishing his people. Israel, who he chose, who he delivered out of Egypt, he nevertheless killed the entire first generation because they did not follow him, trust him, do things his way. Anybody in here going to say that you have actually followed God's word 100% all the time and done everything he said to do and that you've been obedient to all his rules and you've done? No, nobody's going to say that. And yet, you have the promise of salvation. What changed? Did God change? No, same God. Did you get good? No, you're still a human like every other human. You'd be just like these people if it weren't for the fact that God in his mercy and in his grace set his kindness on you, put his spirit in you, converted you, drew you, turned you from yourself, and then changed something really important. What changed? The covenant changed. The old covenant said, do it or die. We're under the new covenant that says, he did it, you live. It's an enormous change of covenant, but God didn't change. This is the same God you're dealing with. There are people out there who have a difficulty with the notion that God would put people in hell. They struggle with that idea. Look at the God of the Old Testament. He has no problem at all wiping out entire nations of people. He has no problem at all condemning whole people groups. And he's the same today. But he made an eternal covenant with his son before the foundation of the world that his son would have a people. Therefore, the change of covenant allows you to stand before this God, this same God, and stand there forgiven, undefiled. The writer of Hebrews says, perfected forever, spotless, unblemished. And it's not because you were that good, and it's not because God changed. It's because he allowed his son to establish a newer, higher, better covenant. And if there was ever a time to be thankful, it's when you come to the realization that he decided in his great sovereignty that you would be born under this covenant.
Amen.
Yeah? All right, let's keep going. I said I wasn't going to comment. I was just going to read it out. And, well, it's a lot going on. Verse 15. For if you turn away from following him, he will once again abandon them in the wilderness, and you will destroy all these people. Then they came near to him and said, we will build here sheepfolds for our livestock and cities for our little ones. But we ourselves will be armed and ready to go before the sons of Israel until we have brought them to their place, while our little ones live in the fortified cities because of the inhabitants of the land. We will not return to our homes until every one of the sons of Israel has possessed his inheritance. For we will not have an inheritance with them on the other side of the Jordan and beyond, because our inheritance has fallen to us on this side of the Jordan toward the east. So Moses said to them, if you will do this, if you will arm yourselves before the Lord for the war, and all of you armed men cross over the Jordan before the Lord until he has driven out his enemies out from before him, and the land is subdued before the Lord, then afterward you shall return and be free of obligation toward the Lord and toward Israel, and this land shall be yours for a possession before the Lord. That's interesting language, and I don't want to pass over it. Notice that he said, if you will arm yourselves, and if you will join us in the war, and then look at the language, if you will do this and arm yourselves before the Lord, and you cross over Jordan before the Lord, until he has driven his enemies out from before him, then you'll be free of your obligation. Why were they so sure that it was God that was going to do all the fighting? I mean, they said, come on, you got to arm yourself. You got to come fight with us. But who got all the credit?
God
got all the credit. Now remember, God just prepped them for this. Remember, they just had a fight, a war with the Amorites. How many people from Israel died in the war with the Amorites? None, not a one. They took a head count and came back and told Moses, everybody's accounted for. Even though there had just been this massive slaughter, nobody from Israel died. God proving that he had preserved his people. So now they have the confidence to know that if they'll just do it God's way, God will fight for them. Wouldn't you think if you had just been through what they just been through, you just fought the Amorites, nobody from your camp died. Wouldn't you be like, woohoo, whoop, whoop. Wouldn't you be like... Wouldn't you be like, let's go get the land. We are undefeatable. Nobody died in our last encounter. Give me a city. I'll take it myself. You know, Caleb's going to do that. Caleb's an old man. When it comes time to start conquering land, he goes, give me this hill. I'll take it myself. Oh, I like that attitude. That's when you finally get that confidence. The Lord is fighting for me. So they give all the credit to God, which is exactly where it belongs. Nobody's going to be able to say, I got this land because I conquered this land. They're going to say, I got this land because God gave it to me as a gift. Verse 23, but if you will not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. That's a rather infamous Old Testament phrase. And by the way, in my own lifetime, it has proven to be true. Can I get a witness?
Amen.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, we human beings have a tendency to think, that we can get away with a certain amount of stuff because nobody knows. No one was around to see me do it. No one knew I did it. I'm not going to tell anybody I did it. I did it in the dark, behind closed doors, with a hat on, with, you know, no one knows. And yet, here Moses says, be sure of this. Your sin will find you out. I can't even tell you how many people I have talked to in life who have come and said to me, I regret so much what I did last week, 2 months ago, 3 years ago, 20 years ago. I rebelled against God and I'm paying the price today. And I regret it so much. And I always think of this verse. I always think, well, you were told in advance, be sure your sin will find you out. You know, the writer of Hebrews says that whom the Lord loves, he chastens. That's a word for spank. He whips the ones that he has chosen. And the ones he loves, he chastens. That's a tough one for kids to get a hold of. As we chasten our children and say, I do this because I love you. And they go, this doesn't feel like love. And it doesn't feel like love to us. But that's why the writer of Hebrews goes on and says that if you endure that chastening, it brings about the peaceable fruit of righteousness. Because when you live before God, doing things His way, same theme as what we're reading here in Numbers, when you do things His way, it just goes more peaceably for you. There's a whole lot less chastening because your sin is going to find you out. And when it does, there's always a price to pay. Look, I'll be 55 soon. And if I know anything for certain, young people, and by young people I mean anybody 55 and under. Yeah. Now, that's because you probably already know this. I'll tell you this for certain. Your sin will find you out. It's just a fact of life. It's a fact of Christian life. The longer you walk with Christ, the more real that will become to you. We talk a lot here about who you are in Christ and therefore how you ought to live. What is your inspiration for living the Christian life? What is your inspiration for mortifying the flesh? What is your inspiration for walking in accord with the things you say you believe? Well, one inspiration is, who are you? I go back to that one every time. Who are you? Who are you in the Lord? Are you the chosen, the elect of God? If you are the redeemed of God, well, then He has bought you with a price, and therefore act like it. But here's another great inspiration. Your sin will find you out. So, I've got to keep moving. I'm not going to get anywhere near where I wanted to get tonight, but build yourselves cities for your little ones and your sheepfolds for your sheep, and do what you have promised. And the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben spoke to Moses, saying, your servants will do just as my Lord commands. Our little ones, our wives, our livestock, and all our cattle shall remain there in the cities of Gilead, while your servants, everyone who is armed for war, will cross over in the presence of the Lord to the battle, just as my Lord says. So Moses gave command concerning them to Eleazar the priest and to Joshua the son of Nun and to the heads of the fathers' households of the tribes of the sons of Israel. And Moses said to them, if the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben, everyone who is armed for battle, will cross with you over the Jordan in the presence of the Lord, and the land will be subdued before you, then you shall give them the land of Gilead for a possession. But if they will not cross over with you armed, they shall have possessions among you in the land of Canaan. So the deal is, if they come and fight, they can have what they ask for. If they don't, they have to come into the land of Canaan, which means everybody now gets a smaller portion. If you take the two large tribes and all their livestock and you move them east of the Jordan River, there's more land in Canaan for the rest of you. Otherwise, they're going to come and take a bigger portion of the land. And the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben answered and said, as the Lord has said to your servants, so we will do. We ourselves will cross over armed in the presence of the Lord into the land of Canaan, and the possession of our inheritance shall remain with us across the Jordan. So Moses gave to them, to the sons of Gad, and to the sons of Reuben, and to the half-tribe of Joseph's son Manasseh. I can't read past this without talking about it for a moment. Anybody here ever had a Mormon at your door? Okay. I had a couple young Mormons at my door a while ago. And after we talked for about an hour on the porch, very pleasant conversation, ever since then, when they canvass my neighborhood now, they point at my house and keep moving. It's true. I've watched them come down the road, point at my house, and keep going. One of the things that I confronted these two fellows about, a young man and an older man, the younger fellow being trained by the older fellow, well, I started the conversation by saying, I'm a pastor of a Christian church. I'm a Bible-believing Christian. Do you think I am going to inherit heaven? And of course, they're stuck because they say that they are another testament of Jesus Christ. And so they say, well, yes, I believe then that you're going to go to heaven. Yeah, I believe that. I believe that you're saved if you're a Bible-believing Christian pastor. Yes. I mean, what are they going to say? No. And so they said that. And I said, well, then what are you offering me that I don't already have? And they said, and I quote, well, it's the same thing, it's just more. I said, it's more of what? It's more of heaven? It's more of salvation? It's more, what is it you're offering me more of? And they said, more knowledge of the history of God's people. And I said, tell me more about the history of God's people. And they began to tell me about how the tribe of Joseph came to America. And they talked quite a bit about the tribe of Joseph. Talk to any Mormon and they will talk to you about the tribe of Joseph. And so I let them talk for a while until the young man was pretty impressed with the older fellow's explanation of the history of America and its inclusion of the tribe of Joseph. And then I told them that there is no tribe of Joseph. And they were hornswoggled and befuddled and other multisyllabic adjectives. They were completely bumfuzzled by the fact that I said to them, there is no tribe of Joseph. Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, received the birthright blessing, particularly Ephraim, and the Bible says that they continued with the other 12 tribes of Israel. There is no tribe called Joseph, even though there are references in the Bible occasionally to the descendants of Joseph. It's Ephraim and Manasseh and those two houses. You will notice that here in the book of Numbers, which is an accounting of the people of Israel, Moses gave to them, to the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben, and to the half-tribe of Joseph's sons, Manasseh. You can't be more specific than that. There is an entire tribe called Manasseh, an entire tribe called Ephraim, and they are the offspring of Joseph. There is no tribe of Joseph. You understand? So the next time they bicycle up to your driveway, ask them about that. Because if they don't know that fundamental fact of biblical history, then when they offer you more, there's not really a whole lot more they can tell you. All right, we're moving on. So Moses gave them to the sons of Gad, to the sons of Reuben, and the half-tribe of Joseph's son Manasseh, the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and the kingdom of Og, the king of Bashan, and the land with its cities, with their territories, the cities of the surrounding land. And the sons of Gad built Dibon and Ataroth and Aroer. And then it goes into the cities that Reuben and Gad built in that area. And Moses gave them that land. Starting in chapter 33 is a review of the different places that Israel went for 40 years. This is one of the unique characteristics of the Bible. Again, a little earlier, Bob and I were talking, and I was saying that in my earliest years, after I left the church and then went through my rock and roll years, and then I went through years of just kind of wandering, and wandering spiritually and theologically, and so those were kind of my comparative religion years. And I read the Gita, and I read Quran. And I was telling him I, at the time, was working a lot out of Dawnbreaker Studios where Seals and Croft were, and they were Baha'i, and they gave me a lot of Baha'i literature, and I read that. But I kept looking for anything that had rigor. I kept looking for something that had substance. And by the time I did return to the Bible, one of the things that kept leaping out at me, in contrast to all the other religious literature I could lay my hands on, was that the Bible kept giving you information that you could check. It kept giving prophecies that you could check to see if they came true, but it kept naming names, places, location, geography. If you take the time someday and go through chapter 33 and look at all the names that are named of the different areas and the different cities, and you're going to have to get an old map to do it. Follow it, and you can follow the path that they took through the wilderness until they ended up right back here at the border of Canaan at Jordan. And now, 3,400 years later, archaeology is saying, hey, we found out where they went. Turns out it was the same place. This is one of the things I really, really like about the Bible, and one of the reasons that when comparing it to other religious literature, I was able to say, this has substance. This has some concrete to it, and this allows you to go back and check, and they want you to go back and check. You know, Paul, when he was talking about the resurrection of Christ, wrote and said, he was seen. He was seen of Cephas, and he was seen of the 12, and he was seen of over 500 brethren, the most of whom are still alive. Why would he bother to say that?
So you go check.
Just check it. Don't take my word for it. Go check these things. It's one of the things I really love about the Bible, is that it keeps telling you to check it out. Check and see if these things are true. And that's what chapter 33 really allows you to do. It's 49 verses of reading words I can't pronounce, so we're just going to take it as a given and move forward. Chapter 33, verse 50. Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross over the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you and destroy all their figured stones, which means all their idols, and destroy all their molten images, and demolish all their high places. And you shall take possession of the land and live in it, for I have given the land to you to possess it. God just told Israel, I have given you land that already has people in it. So go in there and drive them out. Is that fair?
Yes.
Is that fair? Look at what's happening right now in the Middle East. I mean, this has been a constant problem for several generations of presidents, really ever since 1948, ever since the establishment of Israel as an independent nation over there in the Middle East. There's been the question of, well, what about the occupiers? What about the people who are in the land? And so with every new peace treaty that comes up, there are always negotiations about, well, how much is Israel willing to give away in order to make peace, in order to be able to stay in their land? And everybody in the world thinks that that's going to be the solution. If they can just find a reasonable amount of the land of Canaan that Israel gets, and then a reasonable amount of land that the Arab occupiers get, if they can just both finally settle that, okay, this is enough, then there will finally be peace in the Middle East. No, there won't. There will never be peace in the Middle East until the Prince of Peace comes. And then he will establish peace in the Middle East. Because the land that everybody's fighting about is land that God gave to Israel. And back here, there were occupiers in the land. And God was unimpressed with their claims of ownership, and said to his people, I'm with you. I was with you in the last fight. I'll fight for you. And we're just going to move these people out of the way. And I'm going to establish you in the land and give it to you as an everlasting covenant. Is that fair?
He made it.
He made the land. The question again is, The whole world is busy trying to create a deal in the Middle East that everybody will agree is fair. Is God interested in fairness? Or whatever he does, is it fair? God's not interested in fairness. God is interested in his own sovereign will being carried out on the planet. The last thing you want from God is fairness. Yeah, yeah. The last thing you want from God is what you deserve. If God ever decided to be fair, we're in hell. And rightfully so, because that's fair. You don't want that. You want mercy, you want grace, and you want the kind of sovereignty that picks and chooses. Because that's the only way anybody gets to go to heaven. Nobody deserves it. Fairness would condemn everybody. But if God picks and chooses in his mercy and in his sovereignty, then you and I have hope. I look at things like this and I think, you know, there were probably people living in Canaan who were just living their life, not doing any harm, raising some sheep, taking care of their family, doing their work every day. And here come the Israelites coming in, wiping out people, and they keep conquering and conquering because they have a God that's unlike any of our gods, because our gods are wood and stone, and I go up in the groves and the high places and I worship my gods, but their God seems to actually fight for them. And what he's doing is just wiping out whole people groups. And if I'm that guy, if I'm that Canaanite, I'm arguing that it's not fair. What did I do? And yet God can come in and say, these are my people and this is my land and I can do what I want with what is mine and I am giving them this. I am confident that pretty much every day of my life, the accuser of the brethren has an opportunity to go before God and say, did you see that? See what he did this time? The accuser of the brethren has me dead to rights every day. And he should be able to go and say to God, you can't take that one to heaven. I've seen him. I know what he's like. And if you bring him to heaven, that's not fair. And I am really happy that the same God who could say to Israel, I've chosen you, therefore I give you this everlasting inheritance, I'm really glad that God is still at work. And by the way, are these Israelites the good ones? No. No, they're still the sinful group that God chose. And so he chooses his people, and when he chooses his people, he can say, these are mine, and therefore I give them an inheritance that's not fair. And even though there are going to be, you know, 1/3 of the angels of heaven that were thrown out of heaven, that are going to argue, not fair, not fair. I got thrown out of heaven and Tim went in. How is that fair? It's not about fairness. It's about sovereignty. It's about God being able to say, you Canaanites, I left you there for 400 years. What did we see last week? I left you there to fill up your iniquity. The sin of the Amorites had not yet come to its full fruition. That's what God told Abraham when he made the Abrahamic covenant with him. He said, I'm going to take your descendants into a land where they're not known and they're going to serve for 400 years because the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Then I will bring you back to this land and give you this land and you will drive them out. So for the shepherd who's walking around going, I'm just living my life, hanging out in Canaan, taking care of my family, what he didn't know was that he was living in the fullness of the iniquity of generations of his forefathers who didn't know Yahweh, the real God, who didn't love that God, didn't follow him, and in their sense of self-sufficiency had no concept that they were under God's condemnation until it was too late. Let's apply that, shall we? There's a whole world right now walking around thinking they're just fine, doing their thing, getting up, going to work, taking care of stuff, and arguing that they're pretty good people. And they have no idea that they are under the condemnation of God. And they won't know it till the day the judgment falls. You want proof? Noah. The whole generation didn't know a thing till it started raining. And yet they had the witness. They had a guy building an ark for 120 years. That's a clue. And yet, because they were hateful in their hearts and sinful, and because God looked down on the residents of the earth and it said that their hearts were nothing but wickedness continually. And so God brings about a flood and wipes them out. And then Peter picks that up and says, the same way as in the days of Noah. That's how it's going to be when the judgment of God falls. There will be people marrying, given in marriage, looking forward to the future, looking forward to what's coming next, planning their life, getting up every day, going to work, thinking it's just another day, and the judgment of God is going to fall, and they're going to be completely awestruck by it and condemned by it. And the elect of God will get what they don't deserve that God promised them on the basis of a covenant. Why is Israel getting this land? Because he promised it to Abraham. Why are we getting our inheritance? Because God promised it to Christ. And it's not fair. And I love how not fair it is. But this is the same God constantly teaching, constantly demonstrating what he's like, constantly showing himself to be a certain way. And one of the ways he is sovereign enough to choose people and say, I'm going to be good to you. I'm going to be merciful to you, and you don't deserve it. And I'm going to give you this inheritance. I'm going to give you a land of milk and honey. And it's going to be yours just because I say so. Because I promised to Abraham. Because I was going to use you to drive out the Amorites. And for 400 years, I wasn't going to introduce myself to the Amorites until their iniquity was full. And the first time they meet me, it's going to be in judgment. Wow. It's a really sovereign God. Verse 54, and you shall inherit the land by lot according to your families. To the larger you shall give more inheritance, and to the smaller you shall give less inheritance. Wherever the lot falls to anyone, that shall be his. You shall inherit according to the tribes of your fathers. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come about that those whom you let remain of them will become like pricks in your eyes and as thorns in your side, and they shall trouble you in the land in which you live. For those of you who know the rest of the story, you know that there were some local Canaanites who made deals, even some through trickery, so that they weren't completely driven out, and boy, does this come true. They become a constant problem for the children of Israel. And it shall come about that as I plan to do to them, so I will do to you. There's a firm warning, huh? I plan to drive them out of the land. And if you don't, I'll drive you out of the land. Wow. At that point, there are instructions about how to apportion Canaan, how to break out Canaan, who gets what. And that takes up all of chapter 34. I wanted to get to chapter 35 tonight. That's really where I wanted to spend the bulk of the evening. But it's 8 o'clock. So I'm going to tell you what we can look forward to next week. Next week, God's going to say, make 48 cities for the Levites. And take 6 of those cities and make them a city of refuge. Brand new concept. Brand new idea. Why would you need a city of refuge?
To run away from your
captors. To run from the avenger of blood. When you're guilty and you know you're guilty, you can run to the city of refuge and be safe from the avenger of blood until something specific happens. When the high priest dies, you're free. So we'll look at that next week and see if we can't, I don't know, find a gospel message in it. Because I think there's probably one there.
There might be some theology.
There might be some theology in there. So we'll do a little digging in there and see if we can't mine out a few nuggets of gold from there.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.